into this event and all the political, social, cultural context around it, which is very important. This also is a book that looks at the repression that student activists faced, and it's particularly important and meaningful to think about that in the context of the repression we're seeing today of Palestinian students and also students involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement by university administrations in Montreal and beyond. So here's my conversation with Nalini Mohabir about the book that she co-authored, The Fire That Time.
So the name of the book is The Fire That Time. And you've collected, Nalini, these writings and essays, also documents and some photos that speak to a very important event of radical anti-racist student organizing here in Montreal, Jiajiage, Munyang, but also, of course, not just students. Often it's called the Sir George Williams Affair, but of course it spoke to a broader movement of Caribbean and Black consciousness and organizing here in Quebec, and of course as connected to North America and most importantly also the Caribbean. I found the project striking in the sense that it's such an important tool for now. You know, in the present, you know, there's so much discussion about student activism, and that's a very important focus point. But often in the media, student activism is talked about in kind of in time capsules or like vacuums that don't have any historical context. And I feel like this work is maybe a really important one to focus on right now because of this moment of student organizing, particularly around Palestine, but about these questions of institutional racism, these questions of power in the university. Maybe you could just first start by introducing yourself and just giving us a brief outline of The Fire That Time and the project.
Thank you so much for offering me this opportunity to reflect on the book project. It was something, so first of all, my name's Nalini Mohabir. I'm an associate professor at Concordia, but sorry, I hesitate because that doesn't feel like my primary identity and always feels kind of weird to say that. I'm somebody with Caribbean heritage and somebody who comes out of an activist organizing community mobilizing background before academia, and hopefully it's something I carry with me into academia. As you said, the book is tries to capture that spirit of transnational organizing that was happening in the 1960s. I should say, though, it wasn't me alone who collected those stories. So I have a co-editor, Ronald Cummings, who's at McMaster University. But really, it's so much bigger than the two of us. It was a collaborative effort as we've tried to reflect in the book with those who were present in 1969, with activists in, you know, the Caribbean as well as in Montreal, with young people and older people across generations. In terms of the structure of the book, we tried to reflect the way this moment starts in what might be seen as a kind of small microcosm of Montreal, which is the ninth floor of then Sir George Williams University, but really ripples out, you know, beyond Montreal to Toronto, across the border into the US, and over to the UK, France, and the Caribbean. So the first half of the book is focused on Montreal, and the second half on that transnational ripple effects.
When you say transnational, I could take a stab at trying to define that, but it'd be cool to also just hear from you, like, what does that mean for you? And also why thinking about politics through that lens of transnational frameworks is important now.
Thank you for calling me out on jargon. By transnational, all I mean is at the most basic is, you know, across nations. So when something happens in one nation, like transnational migration, for example, means when somebody might migrate to one nation but might have investments still in their home country, and so they have a transnational relationship. So transnational organizing, we mean when a protest might happen in one country but then is connected to another. So for example, in 1969, we have the Sir George Williams occupation in Montreal. Then in 1970, we have students in Trinidad and Tobago protesting in support of the students here in Montreal. And then their protest in Trinidad and Tobago kicks off the Black Power Revolution in Trinidad and Tobago. So that's one instance. Another instance in which I might call this transnational is that the year before, so I mean, one of the questions that we might have is, is this a protest or is this a part of a movement, right? And what's the difference? But, you know, I think of a protest as sort of more a one-off, but a movement is that difficult work of, you know, sustaining a political engagement, analysis, struggle over, you know, a longer period of time. So in 1968 in Montreal, we have the Congress of Black Writers, which precedes the Sir George Williams occupation, where we have a number of thinkers, activists, scholars from the Caribbean converging on Montreal. One of them is Walter Rodney, who was teaching in Jamaica at the time, and he was he had a practice which at Concordia they use the term University of the Streets. In Jamaica, Walter Rodney would call that groundings, where he took the university beyond the campus to places like Trenchtown and reasoned with Rastas about, you know, what does a Marxist critique mean for their lives in Jamaica. So in doing so, he was seen as a threat to the conservative government in power at the time in Jamaica. So when he came to Montreal, he was actually banned from returning to Jamaica. So his being here and sharing these ideas of groundings and what it means to be a university beyond the campus, a university of the streets, to ground with people in the communities is another way in which we might see, you know, a transnational circulation of ideas, because after Canada, then he moves back to Guyana. So we see these figures at the time moving across spaces, connecting with each other as part of a Caribbean diaspora, even though they weren't all necessarily living in Montreal.
And so back to the fire that time. So for people who are hearing this and might not have heard about the Sir George Williams affair, so this is in downtown Montreal at Concordia University. It's maybe an event, but it's of course in this context you're talking about. What are like a few key points that you would think are important to communicate today about this event, and also how it relates to your book project?
I think, you know, in this moment where we see daily just people lining up for food and dying in front of the cameras, and, you know, our government's turning away and ignoring and in fact being complicit in a genocide that's happening, and to see students who've stood up in protest, who've developed, encampments in solidarity with Palestinians being targeted, international students in particular being threatened with deportation. I think it's really important for us to turn back to this moment in 1969 to understand at least what's happening in the Canadian context, where often we as Canadians tend to look across the border to the U.S. In this moment, like looking at Trump, for example, and think like, oh, what's happening there could never happen here. But in 69, those were international students from the Caribbean who were in Canada, maybe no more than at the most 5 years, who were being discriminated against, who, when they went through the proper channels of the university, proper in quotes, to complain, their complaints were ignored by the administration. So to stand up and hold what is the costliest student protest in Canadian history, in terms, which is often the way it's framed, there was approximately $2 million of damage to computers in the aftermath, blamed on the students, although debatable whether they were at fault. But it's also the largest protest against racism in Canada to happen on a university campus. And so they took great risks in you know, making sure that, you know, their voices were heard, that their complaints did not go unnoticed, that their concerns were heard not just by the administration, but, you know, again, heard in the Caribbean, which counters this idea of Canada being a benevolent kind of, you know, soft power that wants to create spaces to of education and dialogue for students in the global south, when maybe the reality, or not maybe, the reality is much more extractive, which these students were trying to point out. And for that, you know, their moment of protest went all the way up to Canadian Parliament, where politicians debated deportations at that time, and where when the students were arrested after the university administration called the Montreal police on them, and the police, as documented by the students themselves, beat or even tortured some of the students in that process of arresting them. And they, what makes that moment in particular so powerful was that it was a moment of anti-colonial international protests. So we see international student movements around the world that were trying to, you know, seek liberation. So in this case, although the Canadian government threatened them with deportation, the newly liberated Trinidadian government, which had gained independence from Britain in 1962, so only, you know, 7 years prior, paid the bail money for those students so that they could be out, which means then that their ambassadors supported international students studying abroad and did not see protest as something to be frowned upon or something to be stamped out, but actually was understood by the government as to why it's necessary in countries such as Canada.
You talked about this being one of the most, well, actually the most significant anti-racist protest led by students. I think in the contemporary context, it's not often articulated. I mean, of course, in some circles it is, of this, the racism and the systemic racism that's playing out today in terms of how Palestinian solidarity protests and particularly student leaders, racialized student leaders, are treated. So that what's happening now is not happening in a vacuum, right? And I think your work and this book speaks to that sort of trajectory of, it was like colonially, you know, systemic racism informed by colonial infrastructures ideologically and power-wise, in regards to power. Could you talk a bit about that, like the sort of like that moment of anti-racist action, the critical issues highlighted at that time, and also today, and why understanding the repression against Palestine activism from a lens of anti-racism is important.
I think it's so important because obviously, you know, if what is happening, like obviously is happening within a colonial context, well, you know, what's bound up in that? It's racism, right? Racism and colonialism go hand in hand. So if we think about the 1969 moment, well, I guess I would turn to an essay Sylvia Winters, the Jamaican scholar, wrote in relation to the Rodney King riots, where she is highlighting the way the media reported the protests that occurred in the so-called Rodney King riots, framed it as people who were the conceptual other, who were not North American, North American being defined as white, law and order, rule-abiding peoples, the so-called rational, as opposed to the irrational, non-human, colonial subject, conceptual other. So we definitely saw that playing out in 1969, where the students who were who had organized and taken over the computer center, because strategically they felt that the university would not attack them in this space where valuable equipment was, were deemed to be having a computer party by one journalist, Dorothy Eber, for example, sort of framing it as, you know, an irrational act. And so when we turn to this present moment, I guess what I would turn to and who I always turn to, because I find her writing so profound and helps me think through so much that's happening in the present, is Dionne Brand, A Map to the Door of No Return, where she describes this moment where King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain had funded the Reconquista of Granada, so the Arab Spain, and then took that money that they got from expelling Muslims and Jewish people from Spain and funded Columbus's journey across the ocean to colonize the Americas. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand, one, that these movements are all connected, and two, that there has been a long, even before 1492, right, with the Crusades, such a long history of hatred against Muslims that I think, you know, we can see you know, the way, if we think about the conceptual other, we have to be conscious of the way people have been framed. You know, myself as somebody who looks South Asian, although it's not a term I would use to describe myself, you know, might be seen as a kind of model minority or whatever those stereotypes are, or passive or docile around being Asian, whereas I think Muslims and are seen as being radical, not radical as in a radical social justice activist, but radical as in dangerous. And we see that playing out when people come together to claim space and to protest.
The moment we're in right now, you can see the contradictions in the expression of liberal institutions around sort of claiming an anti-racist mantle and sort of like inclusion and diversity discourse, totally not matching up with what is actually happening in terms of military, state, corporate policy. Especially, you know, Trump has really taken the decorations off in a way, like of a lot of these institutions. And I feel like the last couple years in Western universities, we've seen that same thing, whereas like there's this discourse of universities being anti-racist spaces and inclusive spaces, etc. But then at the same time, you have this repression going on that is informed by everything you're talking about, right? And so in a way, it's like 1969 never ended, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for most people who come from colonized countries, identify as colonial subjects, identify with, although it sounds cliche, with the idea that the past is not past, that we're still living in the colonial present, and we can see the way colonial powers organize our lives every single day. It's just all around us. I completely agree with you about the way universities and other institutions and agents of the state use those terms such as diversity and inclusion. I feel very skeptical of them myself because I do think it's a kind of corporate management tool or a way to, as Sarah Ahmed says, to file a complaint and then file it away so that it looks like one is doing something but nothing is being done. Yet I find myself in this odd, contradiction where I feel I also have to defend it because with everything that's happening south of the Canadian border, in terms of, getting rid of critical ethnic studies, black studies, anything with any kind of radical subjectivity to it, that it's, it might be this idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion is the only mechanism that we have within these institutions to have a presence. Although it's not a radical approach, it's maybe the only strategy left, so I feel the need to defend it.
That's a very haunting and important point for the present moment. Back to your the collective project that you worked on, the fire that time. Maybe just to end, are there like a few pieces that come to your mind after having this discussion that like you're like, oh, like that's a really cool piece from the collection that I'd like to highlight, or to speak to so people can check it out?
I honestly, in all honesty, have to say that I think every piece is a cool piece. So that's a hard question for me to answer. But I think, like, coming back, I guess in this present moment, if we think about why this history is important, I think it's important to think about it not as a history that ended. And there's many ways in which we can see that. But one of the ways in which I'd like to highlight is, two chapters on newspapers. One is Ronald Cumming's chapter in the student newspapers in Jamaica, and the other is Dorothy Williams' chapter on Black community newspapers in Montreal. Because what that points us to is the ways in which, after the protest, sort of the 2 weeks of occupation ended with a mysterious fire that was set by someone. There's not been an inquiry, an official inquiry, so we don't have evidence as to who set the fire. The students were accused of that, but they did, they vehemently deny that and have other alternative theories. Following that, they were arrested, some deported, some lives changed forever, but they never stopped speaking about this moment. And the students at Sir George, both black and white, they had used the organ of the Georgian, the student newspaper at the time, to express their views. The offices of that student newspaper were raided by the RCMP. But they created alternative newspapers that circulated kind of like zines at the time. Then they went on to, some students went on to create Uhuru, which was one of the most important Black community newspapers in Montreal,
That lasted for a long time.
that lasted for a long time, that had critiques of funding, nonprofits, the Peace Corps activists going to supposedly to help the Caribbean, but who they identified as agents of the CIA. I mean, such important information, and again, transnational, to use that word, mm-hmm. information that circulated mm-hmm. in these mm-hmm. seemingly local newspapers, but never local. That is how we build a movement. I mean, that's one of the aspects mm-hmm. In which we can learn how to build a movement, is mm-hmm. to not let the issue drop, to mm-hmm. continue to make sure that we have means to get our voices heard and to people, you know, who want to engage with this.
Thanks, Nalini.
Well, thank you, Stefan. Thanks.
That was a conversation with Nalini Mohabir, the co-author of The Fire That Time. Look it up. It's a very important collective title looking at the anti-racist student movements in Montreal, particularly at Concordia University, but also beyond, in the late 1960s. Thanks so much to Nalini for being on the program this week. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search for Free City Radio through your preferred podcast platform. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, online at cjsf.ca, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC, home of McFog the Dog.
In the last past year, CJSF has significantly strengthened its local and community reporting to put more stories and neighborhood news on the air. As local news continues to be under threat, your support is more important than ever. Help us rise higher and reach further with a donation to CJSF's 2025 Fund Drive at cjsffunddrive.ca or text DONATE to 778-782-2573.